Good afternoon and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is off this week. I'm Jay Pierce sitting in today. We'll have a variety of us sitting in for Celeste over the next several days. This afternoon, we'll be talking about the roles that many Farmer City residents played in World War II as chronicled in the book, Their Roles Remembered, Farmer City Veterans in World War II. This book is a joint effort by three men to gather as many firsthand stories as possible from fellow veterans. As a recent Associated Press account put it, before the voices of World War II veterans fall silent, it also relates as much information as it was possible to gather about those who couldn't be tracked down for one reason or another, or who are no longer living, some of whom lost their lives in or as a result of the war. Roles was published by and is available from the Farmer City Genealogical and Historical Society. The authors of the book are John Dawson, who was a member of the Army's 1st Special Service Force. John Overton was part of a prisoner of war interrogation team attached to the 3rd Army and later the 89th Infantry Division. And Gene Hauser was part of the, as he puts it in the book, behind the lines support. He served as a clerk typist in the Mediterranean Theater of Operations. And today they join us in our studio. And gentlemen, welcome. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We would also welcome your questions and thoughts and perhaps some reminiscence, some experiences, some stories of your own. If you'd like to join in the conversation at any point during the hour, our telephone number locally is 333-9455. And if you're calling long distance, you can call us toll-free at 800-222-9455. Again, those numbers, 333-9455, and that spells out WILL, of course. And if you're calling us long distance, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455 or WILL, if that's easier for you to remember. Well, first, why was it important, and anyone who wants to respond, and then I'll identify you so that we can get a voice reference for the listeners going here. Why was it important for you to do this book? How did the idea come about, and why about 8 years ago, I guess, did you all decide to do this?
Yes, there was a tent at the Heritage Days in Farmer City in early June, I think, and the veterans came in and sat and talked among themselves, and John Overton thought there must be some stories worth putting down, and so we got together and, we decided to expand it into a full-fledged history of the town, of the war in it, we started with Fred Graff was one of our original numbers, and his remark was, it'll be great if we live to finish it, mm-hmm. But he didn't live. So we picked up Gene Hauser, who has went the last lap with us.
And that's John Dawson, who was just speaking by way of voice reference. So it started as a thought of just collecting some stories among fellow veterans, and then And then it about what point did you decide then, John, that you'd go with a fully blown edited and produced hardcover book here?
It was pretty early in the game, and we thought we'd avoid a lot of trouble by setting down our parameters, like exactly how far out of town you'd extend, or who was a farmer city boy, and but you complicate things about as bad as whether that's necessary. You miss a good story that's just over the line.
Geographically speaking, yeah. So how did you decide who would be included? Obviously, some are outside of the actual city limits of Farmer City, but still included as part of the Farmer City family.
Yes, we made it roughly the old high school district. Moore Township, as it was at that day, and we'd give or take a little over the line or back, but then
so it was a matter.
Yes, there was. We found out there were a lot of these fellows like John that had been in Farmer City for 50 years, but they'd moved in after the war. So we thought they were Farmer City boys also. And then we also took in all the members of the veterans organizations in town. And that's where we got into most trouble, because they had the power plant built, and there were a lot of people who were awfully hard to trace. Impossible, I think.
The power plant at Clinton, of course. And so it was a matter of defining the geographic parameters and trying to work within those, and then trying to track down who all this meant and find information about them, and do it, as you mentioned, John, while as many were still alive and able to tell the stories in firsthand. And since you brought up the name, why don't you tell us about Fred Graff? Fred, unfortunately, was a part of the original group.
Yeah.
And John Overton was part of the original group but didn't live to see the project.
Yes. Fred was a personal friend, and he also had excellent qualifications for a project such as ours. From having experience in journalism, he was at one time a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and he wrote for the Wisconsin State Journal. He would have been an excellent collector and recorder of stories, but unfortunately, he passed away before even committing his own story to print.
And that's John Overton's voice you're listening to.
We admired and respected and loved Fred and decided to dedicate the book to him.
And then Gene Overton, you joined. Gene Hauser, I'm sorry.
We joined, but to get the names that we needed, we went to the American Legion and the VFW, and got their membership rolls, and then those that people we couldn't contact, we went to the DeWitt County recorder and went through all the discharge papers of these names that we had. I would pull them out of the file. John Overton would put them in the machine and enlarge them and then print them out. We spent 2 days down there going through all these, and from these discharge papers, we got as much story as possible from these fellows who had already deceased or had moved away, didn't have any family present to interview.
And from there, those who were still alive or had family members, the process was to go and try to track them down and then talk to them and get stories and letters, other things that might contribute.
And that was difficult. Yeah. You approach a fellow and you say, well, for instance, I was over at the Carl Clinic in the waiting room, and Dick Smith was sitting there with his grandson and his wife. And I said, Dick, he lives south of Farmer City, south of Parnell for 50 years as a farmer. I said, Dick, you were in the World War II. Have you written down your story? And he said, no, nobody's been interested in that. And I said, your grandson is sitting there next to you. Has he heard you, what you did in the service? And he said, no. And so I was called back for a conference, and in about 2 weeks, Dick Smith presented a story to John Dawson. And that got him thinking, and a week or so later, he said, John, I've got some more to add to that story. And his is one of the more interesting stories in the whole book. Mm-hmm. He turned out to be a cook on a submarine, and that submarine was credited with sinking a train in the Bay of Tokyo. Soon, near the end of the war, a train would go across a trestle regularly every day, and his captain got permission to fire the last torpedo that the submarine had. And so they did that, and they knocked out the trestle and sank the train. Wow. It's the only submarine credited with sinking a train. And later on, that same submarine was out in the ocean and having trouble with his compass. The navigator couldn't get it to work, and he tells the captain, as near as I can tell you, we're 8 miles up the Burma Road.
8 miles up the road in the submarine.
That's a and good he story. Said, we knew that was wrong.
I would hope so.
Those kind of stories are, the book is full of these interesting, and some of them are tragic stories. Mm-hmm. But we tried to get all that we could from everyone we interviewed.
A lot of the stories that is mentioned in the book, that as you point out in that one, that family members or friends might never have known. That's right. Because some of these people just didn't think it was that interesting or that important to tell the stories. Why is it important that these stories are documented?
Well, it is a part of the history of the time, and I think it makes the younger people more conscious of what the country has been through. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And reading the stories, whether you have an opinion about the rights or wrongs of war any kind of ideas along those lines, this book doesn't make a statement like that. It's relating the personal stories of the people who were involved and as a matter of fact, were there. It doesn't really get into the politics of it and the like. It certainly does get into some of the morality. There are a lot of statements, such as one that I recall and I'll try and remember the name of who it was, that was at a prison camp, Jesse Hammer, the story of Jesse Hammer, who saw a concentration camp and wrote at the end of his story, how man can be so inhumane is hard to understand. And another, Maurice Kent, wrote about Dachau, the concentration camp. I still get half sick thinking about it all these years later. And I know that, John Overton, you had an experience visiting a concentration camp that you wrote about in your section of the book, too. The Ohrdruf, is that how it's pronounced?
Ohrdruf. Right.
And some strong memories of visiting.
Yeah, strong and unpleasant memories. Mm-hmm. Ohrdruf was not one of the more written about stories. It didn't have the publicity of Auschwitz and Dachau. But nonetheless, it was a death camp. And when we visited the camp, we entered a courtyard where we found a mass of tangled bodies of inmates, prisoners who had just been mowed down by machine gun by the guards. those were the people who were too weak to be marched out as our unit was advancing toward the camp. We toured different areas of the camp and found one building with a stack of bodies, probably 4 feet high and 100 feet long. Lime had been sprinkled over the bodies to preserve them. There were numbers handwritten on them with some kind of marking pencil, probably part of the efficient bookkeeping system that the Germans were keeping. And in that same building, we saw, running parallel to the row of bodies, a trench probably 10 feet deep and maybe 4 feet wide. And we looked in there and saw floating in water members of human bodies. And as we were leaving the camp, we passed a mass grave site where the backfilling had been done rather hastily, and some body members weren't fully covered. Here and there we saw protruding out of the earth an arm or a leg. It was not a pleasant experience.
How old were you at the time?
Sir?
How old were you at that time?
Old enough to know better. I was about 25 at that time.
25. Yeah, that's something you're probably, even though you go through training and you had some experience, obviously, in the war at that point, but something that like that is something you really, I would imagine, can't prepare for.
We hadn't been informed to expect anything like that. Mm-hmm. It just came on us in a flash.
There's another story about one of these death camps that I want to get to in a moment, but we do have a phone caller on line four, so if you'll put your headphones on, and we can talk to this caller from Clifton. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just turned my radio down. I want to thank WLL and these three gentlemen for coming on today. This needs to be told, and the story of the veterans needs to be told. I served in the Pacific on a B-24 bomber in World War II, and for these fellows' information, in case you don't know, you each of you lost 292,131 of your buddies died in combat in that war. And one thing I get real aggravated about is the people that think we should not have dropped the atomic bomb. I would give you one more fact, and that is there were 53,400,000 people killed in World War II. We were killing them at about 1 million per month. And those that say we shouldn't have dropped the bomb, I guess they wanted us to keep on killing another million every month until finally we got it over. We would have won it, but I don't know how many men and women would have died invading Japan. And with that, I just want to thank these gentlemen for writing your book and telling your story. And maybe I ought to write one, too.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you much for the call. Clifton, and if you'd like to call in, 333-9455 is our number locally, 1-800-222-9455 if it's long distance for you, and feel free. John Dawson?
Oh, I misunderstood you there. I thought you said Clinton. It was Clifton.
Clifton, yeah, Clifton he was from. But that's another topic, too, that we could follow up on. There, of course, has been controversy throughout the years about the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And a lot of the folks who were in the book, a lot of the veterans who were there, seemed to agree with the caller that had it not been for that, that if the ground war was what eventually ended things, forced a Japanese surrender, that there would be many more lives would have been lost in the course of it. You all have any ideas on that?
I believe it was Admiral Halsey that said an atomic bomb couldn't kill you any deader than a hand grenade. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
We have several stories in there of the fellows who were headed for the Pacific or were in the Pacific, headed, being trained to invade Japan. And they say that they wouldn't be here, their children wouldn't be here, and their grandchildren wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb. There's no doubt about in our minds that it was not justified.
A common estimate of military authorities was that we would have lost at least 1 million men invading the mainland of Japan. Mm-hmm. And something else that's often overlooked in the way of civilian casualties in Japan, the fire bombings that we had been carrying out prior to dropping the A-bomb had taken many, many more lives than the bombs that were of atomic origin.
There were a number of stories that brought out not only new information to families, but some that have brought out information that hasn't been widely publicized in stories, articles, documentaries, films, television specials about the war. One was a story by the story of the experience of Dick Trenkel, and he brought back a story about the Dachau prison camp and some pictures to back it up.
Oh yeah, I should have brought those along. I've got some copies at home.
Mm-hmm. Now this was of some Germans.
Yes, the German guards had been mowed down by some GIs that were, I guess, shocked by what they were seeing.
Uh-huh.
And but I'd never seen any reference to that anywhere before. But these pictures were pretty plain, and they were SS guards, and they were lying in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And I did find some other evidence later on, a book that had been published, and one or two other that were in the making. So it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we were just preparing for the Nuremberg trials, and that was kind of conflicting with the theme, so I think it was played down.
Now, he did turn this evidence over. He turned it over to the government, or who did he bring it back to?
He brought it back in his wallet, I guess.
Oh. But he did. Did he try to tell the story at the time, or did he just keep it with him? And now is the first
evidently
time.
Evidently, he told it to a few friends.
Yeah.
But yeah. I got it from his sister-in-law. He long ago passed away.
Yeah. Interesting.
But there's no doubt that the story is correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you can see why it wouldn't happen there. After what John had described, you feel that the persons responsible should pay.
Yeah, and his evidence was that it wasn't surviving prisoners in retaliation, but it was soldiers who came upon the camp after liberation, but before the guards had gone.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We're talking with, that was John Dawson. Eugene Hauser is with us, and John Overton, World War II veterans, Farmer City residents who have written the book, which is called Their Roles Remembered, Farmer City Veterans in World War II. I'm Jay Pearson for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine today. Again, if you have a story you'd like to contribute to the discussion, if you have a comment or a question, the numbers are 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, and if it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455 will work. Some of the more disturbing experiences we've concentrated on, but there were also others like meeting Bing Crosby or Bob Hope or General Patton in some of the stories. A lot of the stories dealt with day-to-day life, trying to just survive as a soldier in a combat situation or otherwise, trying to get through training for some was quite an experience. But these are the stories in here relate the human experience that these individuals went through. Why don't we talk about some of your individual experiences and what you did during the war. And John Overton, why don't we start with you?
Well, I started in the infantry, 90th Infantry Division in Camp Barkley, Texas. And I underwent what I considered was very rigorous training. At one time, we were given instructions in firing the BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle, and we were told the habit of the machine. The firing pattern was from the lower left to the upper right, so when we fired on a target, I aimed at the lower left corner, and the bullets walked up higher and to the right, and I made expert. And as a result of that, I was rewarded by having the 18-pound rifle hung on my shoulder. And I don't recall just exactly how I got out from under that, but later on I was made supply sergeant, and I think that's probably how I escaped. Well, part of our training, we were on maneuvers in swampland in eastern Texas and western Louisiana. And we found that there were large accumulations of pine needles under some of the pine trees there. The needles were perhaps a foot and a half or 2 foot thick. And the hogs found those to be convenient resting places until we came along looking for a place to bed down at night. And so we rooted out the hogs and slept in their bed.
Now, you were part of a prisoner of war interrogation team.
Right. I was transferred from the infantry to Army Specialized Training Program. We were sent to the University of Missouri for intensive language instruction, also instruction in the geography of Europe, and then sent to Camp Ritchie, Maryland, for specific training in interrogation. Many of the fellows there in our organization were German Jews who had come to this country on their own or were brought by their parents to escape the wrath of Hitler. And before going overseas to their native country, many of them decided it would be to their best interest not to be carrying their German names. And so several of them went to the courthouses and had their names officially changed. A person who had been Gutstein became Gert. And somebody with a Polish name became Foster. And they felt a bit of security by having the name changed.
So who were some of the prisoners of war that you were involved in interrogating? How high up the ranks did some of them get?
We didn't interrogate very many people of significant rank.
Mm-hmm. But some were members.
Pardon?
No, go ahead.
Mainly just common GIs. Some of them, perhaps less common, they were members of the SS force, which were forces trained to be particularly savage. Mm-hmm. And those fellows, when captured, would often attempt to deny being SS men. And we had them remove their shirts, put their arms up, and we inspected their armpits, and when we found an SS tattoo in the armpit, mm-hmm. we had the proof on the man that, yes, he was indeed an SS man.
We'll get to some more of your own experiences, gentlemen, in a moment, but first we have a caller from Farmer City on line four with us. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yeah, I've read a lot of the stories that these gentlemen have included in their book, and I thought one of the more interesting ones was the one about George Ruckman, mm-hmm. Just for sheer persistence and courage and getting out of a really bad situation. I wonder if they could recount that story for the rest of the audience.
It's a good idea.
Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
I think I can recount that. George Ruckman was a pilot of a B-17 that was crippled and forced down. They happened to land in Poland, which had just been liberated from the Germans by the Russians just a few hours before he landed. His plane had I don't know how many engines knocked out, but they needed another engine and a wheel. So they found another B-17 that had crashed about 17 miles away from where this one was. So his crew, and with the assistance of some Polish civilians, he bartered his watch and fountain pens and bought assistance, where they took an engine off that other B-17 and with two telephone poles on the shoulders of 18 men, they carried this 1,300-pound engine back to their plane, installed it, and then they went back to that original plane and dug out a wheel that was frozen in the ground, brought it back and put it on their plane. And after a test flight, they came back and loaded up his crew and the crew from that original B-17, and they flew back to friendly territory. Now, before George passed away, one of his crewmen wrote a letter to George thanking him for his persistence and ingenuity in recovering their B-17. Said if it hadn't been for George, he, his children, his grandchildren would not be here today. After George got back home, he thought it would be necessary or be interesting to get repaid for his personal possessions and his money that he gave to save that plane. And finally, with Senator Dirksen's assistance, they got a bill passed through Congress to repay George $250 for his efforts. And that's mainly the George Ruckman story.
That's Eugene Hauser, who, along with John Dawson and John Overton, have authored Their Roles Remembered, Farmer City Veterans in World War II. And, Gene, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story? You were, as you say it, behind the lines supports as a clerk typist.
Behind the lines, when there were rear echelons, there's probably 20 or 25 GIs for every one man who's up on the front line, keeping the ammo pushed up towards them, keeping the replacement soldiers up to them, and bringing others, the wounded and the rotation fellows back, putting them on ships and bringing them back to the United States. I got, as soon as I got over to Italy, I became attached to a replacement depot, and that was our job. We typed out the travel orders, sending fellows forward and also back. But my experience was quite different from a frontline soldier like John Dawson was. We worked 8-hour shifts, and the 16 hours we were off, they were ours. Not being in Naples, we take a weekend off and we go to Isle Capri or go to the Mount Vesuvius or Pompeii and explore all the sites. Entirely different than the combat life. Mm-hmm. which we were glad to be in that position. But that was where we were placed, and everybody went where they were sent.
John Dawson, you were a member of the Army's first Special Service Force. What was that?
Oh, it was an American-Canadian outfit. It was supposed to be about half and half. Actually, it was about two-thirds American and one-third Canadian. And we were ski, mountain, paratroop, sort of specialized service. We took on the jobs that were a little hard for the regular Army. Mm-hmm. And, well, our first action was at Mount Defensa in Italy, where we went up about a 200-foot cliff using mountain climbing skills. Mm-hmm. And there had been two American divisions and one British division had tried to take Mount Defensa and hadn't succeeded. And our general figured out that we could climb up this part where they weren't looking, and we were on top before they knew we were there. So we took it with fairly small losses. They were heavy losses for us. But mm-hmm. I think in my company there were 9 fellows killed out of about 60.
That's a pretty good percentage, though.
That's an awful percentage. Mm-hmm. And then you have about 3 or 4 wounded for every killed, and there's a lot of space on those trucks coming home.
Uh-huh. But you made it through.
Yes.
No major injuries?
Wasn't scratched.
Wow.
Anywhere. And had over 100 days in the line. Uh-huh. That's within, we call the line within small arms fire. Most units call it within artillery range. And then after that, that was down on the casino front, and then we were 100 days on the Anzio beachhead. And my outfit had about a quarter of the entire perimeter of the beachhead. We were a little outfit of about 1,600 men. Of course, we had the Mussolini Canal between us and them, but almost every night we'd go on patrol. Little patrols, big patrols, maybe up to a battalion with tanks. Hmm. And then when we broke out of Anzio, we spearheaded that, and we were the first troops into Rome. And eventually we ended up in southern France, and we were broken up there.
Now, a lot of the stories, and I understand some of what you're telling is you were interviewed for a History Channel documentary that's going to be upcoming.
Yes, on Saturday, April the 28th.
April 28th.
On the History Channel. Uh-huh. And I should say a few words, but I don't know how many words or how intelligent they'll be.
But you were interviewed for it already?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. April 28th, we can see that. But the stories that are told in this book, for those of us who, I'm even too young to have served in Vietnam and was too old by the time Desert Storm came along or anything else. So I'm kind of one of those in-the-middle generations. I've heard a lot of stories. I've known, people, parents or friends who are in different wars. But it seems like, at least on the surface, the wars that a lot of younger people are experiencing today, for instance, Desert Storm, the word surgical kept coming up in the kinds of missions. Surgical missions were performed. It doesn't seem like there was anything like a surgical mission, like a clean mission in World War II and perhaps in Vietnam from the stories I've heard, too, and in Korea. It seems like you were a lot more on your own to face whatever came at you in the field. There wasn't always a great plan, or if there was a plan, sometimes the plan, you know, fell apart. You were told to go somewhere. You didn't find what you expected. Things did not seem to go surgically, I guess is what I'm saying. So there was a lot more, and not to diminish anybody's role who did fight in Desert Storm and or the war that we're characterizing as maybe a little more surgical. But, you know, the idea now is that we have warheads that can come in from quite a distance and hit a target fairly accurately. Back then, we didn't have that. You had to be resourceful.
And one thing, most people today can hardly realize how long a war this was. And I'll tell you the story of, there was a Bill Howard in our book, mm-hmm. who he had had his wings for 2 months when D-Day occurred. And he was between Iceland and Wales on his way to Europe at the time of the Bulge. And yet he had time for 24 missions and was shot down on the 25th, which is about a normal roll of missions, starting that late. And that was a fairly short tour, and yet, mm-hmm. compared to the whole war.
Yeah.
Until about, I can say Bill Howard was shot down on that 25th mission, and he was a pilot of it, and he saw his crew, he counted them as their parachutes opened. And as he was floating down, as he counted them, then he finally landed. He was so happy to see the German soldiers coming towards him, because the civilians were about to kill him. He'd already seen that several of them had been lynched by the civilians, because you just bombed our house. I'll get even with you. And they were about to kill him, and the German soldiers came and rescued him. He was put in a prison camp.
So it was better to be taken as a prisoner of war, where there were rules to go by that would preserve him in some state.
That's right.
Other than the fate of being at the hands of the residents. Interesting stories in there in the book. The Roles Remembered, Farmer City Veterans in World War II. You were just hearing the voice of Eugene Hauser. John Dawson and John Overton are the other co-authors. And the book was published by the Genealogical Society, Historical Genealogical Society of Farmer City. And it's available for them, I understand, and also from the library and Farmer City. There's a video which also featured some of these stories and also the making of the book, and that was called Before Voices Fade Away. You might have seen it on WILL-TV. It was produced by Insight Productions in Farmer City, and also, I understand, still available if people would like to get a hold of that. In the final, and we only have a minute or so before we need to wrap things up, but I thought if each of you had a brief comment about what this process of gathering these stories and putting out this book has meant to you personally. Gene?
We felt that these stories needed to be saved, and the one main reason, we're saving ours, and we hope that other communities, our size or larger, doesn't matter what size, would interview and get their stories before their veterans pass away. We concentrated on Farmer City and on World War II, but there's Korea and Vietnam that other communities could work on.
Mm-hmm. And I understand somebody might be working on a book about Korea.
Yes.
Okay. John Dawson?
Well, I did want to mention that there's a few of these boys that are in the Twin Cities here now. Mm-hmm. Lowell Dickey, Jack Monin, Joe Schilling, and Dick Watson used to be a dentist. He's deceased now. Mm-hmm. And I about used my time.
Well, John Overton, any final thoughts from you on the making of this?
One thing that I found quite interesting in our work was that the fellowship that we developed between us three fellows and with Jim Tobin, who was the editor of the book.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to mention that at the very end.
In fact, I think he's guilty for our being here today. And he was an expert in bringing our stories together and getting them into print. One observation of mine I thought was quite interesting was that in World War II, it seemed to be not much of an exaggeration to say that wherever the action was, there was someone from Farmer City there. We were on all the continents, on all or almost all the seas. One man made a crash landing on Greenland. Another steered a ship down to Antarctica. One sweated out the heat of New Guinea. Another one, the heat of the Sahara Desert. And many went to Pacific Islands that just looked like dots on the map, like fly specks. They went to islands whose names we'd never heard of before. And one of them was Mog Mog, referred to by Orth Pythman in his story. So reading the book would convince one that if the war hadn't had a title, the book would have given it the right title of World War.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for sharing your stories and for coming here today to talk about this book, Their Roles Remembered, Farmer City Veterans in World War II. Thanks again, gentlemen.